Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see?
Good evening, friends. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Rick Spisak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you to tonight's show. Tonight's show is entitled Unconventional Convention Coverage. So we're going to be hopping back and forth in time, talking about what happened at the conventions now that the fevers have cooled, looking at the campaigns a little bit, getting some firsthand experience from people who were there, both at the Democratic Convention, and we got an on-site view from the Republican Convention as well. I want to get through the news real quick because we've got a clip of tape I want to play you from the Brown and Warren debate up in Massachusetts so that you can hear a little bit of what Elizabeth Warren's doing to for progressive causes. First in the news, we've got these events coming up, the paramilitarism and the assault on democracy in Haiti. This is Thursday, September 27th at the Performing Arts Building. There's going to be Jeff Sprague, University of California, Santa Barbara, investigates the role of right-wing paramilitary in undermining democratic aspirations of the Haitian people. For more information, call 561-799-8226. This is going to be at FAU University. You could also get in touch with the sponsors at DMCGETCH at FAU. Or you can go to monthlyreview.org, press, books, PB3003. Also, Jamaica Independence, 50 Years Later, a lecture by noted author Rachel Manley. That name may ring a bell. This is Wednesday, October 10th, the Board of Trustees Room, Administration Building. Rachel Manley, a member of Jamaica's most famous political family, provides a unique inside perspective on decolonization and independence. Sponsored by the Dorothy F. Schmidt College of Arts and Letters Ethics Studies Certification Program, English Department, Political Science Department, Philosophy Department. For more information, call Rafael DeLeo at FAU also. That's RDALLEO at FAU.org. From Invasion to Exploitation, a lecture, October 14th. They're going to gather at 11:30 a.m. at Northwest 41st Street and Northwest 97th Avenue in Doral, Florida. There'll be discussions about from the invasion of Columbus in 1492 to struggles today in the tomato fields of Florida. The peoples of America suffered 520 years of repression while giving themselves in 520 years of resistance. Join us to work for justice and celebrate our successes from invasion to exploitation. The struggle brings victory from Ecuador to Nicaragua to our tomato fields. And this is sponsored by Code Pink, Miami, and SOA Watch. South Florida co-sponsors include Coalition of Immokalee Workers, Code Pink, and Progressive Democrats of Miami. For information, call Daniela at 786-343-3796. And that would be Spanish and in English. Call Linda at 305-801-0245 or Ray at 754-423-0051. Also coming up on the 21st of October, the Space Coast Progressive Alliance is doing their Progressive Fest up in Melbourne. You got to see this. It's incredible. The progressives from across the state coming together in one room. It's fantastic. There's things for sale, lots of information. There's health testing. It's fantastic. Tables are available for a very reasonable price. You want to contact Space Coast Progressive Alliance, or you can go to the email address, Susan Martin, and this is tablingfest@scpaflorida.com. Great stuff. Also coming up on October 27th, Real Politique. It's the film The Koch Brothers Exposed, also featuring the singing group Pink Slip. And there'll be discussions afterwards, hosted by yours truly, news director Rick Spisak. $5 donation suggested. This is in Boca on October 27th. And by the way, there's a group of progressive activists in the Midwest who've been harassed by the FBI for about a year now, and they're requesting that people contact Assistant Attorney General. This is for more information, go to StopFBINet. The phone number is 312-353-5300, 312-353-5300. They were supporting Palestinian rights and opposing U.S. war. They're still under grand jury threat, I think basically a year later. So if you believe that this is an overreach harassing political activists, peace activists, give them a call. Okay, we've got some news to cover. Of course, the ongoing non-problem at Fukushima, where now there's evidence that these a complete cover-up, and not only in Japan, but also there's a cover-up of nuclear activities in India as well. But first, remember last week we had that interview with a professor regarding the Chicago teacher strike, which is now settled. We contacted the Florida Education Association, and we got this statement from them on the Chicago teacher strike. We certainly watched the strike with great interest because Chicago teachers were working through many of the same issues we've had to deal with here in Florida. We're also concerned about the misuse of testing for evaluation and merit pay, concepts that have never worked and are doomed to failure in their present forms. We're also concerned with issues like proper funding for our schools, class size, and the condition of the classrooms. We salute the Chicago teachers for having the courage to go out on strike to call attention to these issues. That was from Mark Pudlow, spokesman for the Florida Educational Association. We're going to have him on the air and have a full discussion of school-related issues in the near future. Okay, on the BP front, BP and the spill and the stain, the poisoning goes on. Last year, U.S. Coast Guard announced the Gulf Coast would shift to a shoreline cleanup completion plan when they laid out a process for determining how formerly oiled areas can be declared clean. Federal officials, Gulf states signed on to the plan except for Louisiana. State official says it leaves Louisiana vulnerable beaches and marshes open to continued oiling and doesn't hold BP accountable for long-term monitoring and the cleanup of oiled shores. For well over a year, the state has been pushing BP to remove the oil. It's obviously it was there, Graves said. Their refusal to take proactive steps to remove the oil has put us in this predicament now. He added that BP is trying to remove portions of Elmer Island Beach from active cleanup shortly before Hurricane Isaac uncovered the oil there. Graves said the state is concerned because the intrusive mechanical approach to cleaning oil from the beaches will dig up too much of the beach already vulnerable shoreline. Without compacted beach sand, shores will be more exposed to erosion. The process will also impact microorganisms that live in the sand. When you dig up and expose these organisms to sunlight and the elements, you end up killing and changing the ecosystem, Graves said. Graves said the BP's request was blanket deep cleaning process across southern Louisiana, a request that the state finds too blunt and too intrusive. LaForche Parish President Charlotte Randolph said that the cleaning process wasn't ideal, but it might be a necessary evil to get the remaining oil off LaForche's beaches. We're not thrilled with it, but simultaneously we can understand that to get to the root of the problem, they may have to dig further down, Randolph said. India and the Japanese reactors. CAG has been known as one of the few watchdogs of mention in the political morass that exists in India today. If you want further details, look at averyvoice.blogspot.com. The full article is there. Thanks very much. I've got my first guest here. Let me bring on my first guest. Good evening. Is this Mark?
It is. How are you?
Welcome, Mr. Pafford. How are you tonight, sir?
I have a fully charged phone. I've made it on time to our date. And so far, so good.
Okay, that's fantastic. I would like, sir, for you to tell us an update on how's the campaign going so far.
Well, if you're talking about my campaign, it's
sure.
Going well. I do have a right-wing evangelical opposition who is a very nice person, actually. You know, we're just on two different wavelengths. You know, I think so far, who I am. I went for the next 44 days, and hopefully I'll return to Tallahassee.
Well, we're sure counting on it, sir. You know, we see your postings, and we're rooting for you all the way, 100%.
Well, thank you.
We were wondering also if you can give us your reaction to the conventions.
You know, the it's interesting. It's a great question. Nobody's asked me that. I'm going to talk about the Democratic National Convention. The other ones, it's hardly not even talking about it. There were so many lies and hogwash. It's quite amazing. You can spend $50 million and come out with an outcome like that. The Democrats did a pretty good job. I started listening, actually. I was kind of doing some data entry for my campaign, and the gentleman, the governor from Massachusetts, popped on and used the word backbone, and that's actually what got my attention for the rest of the convention. He is just an incredible speaker, Deval Patrick, and it was just a wonderful evening listening to all speeches, and then of course, you know, with the president at the end, I think people walked away pretty.
Oh boy, we're having a little trouble hearing you, sir. You just broke up. Yeah, if there was anything
you
could get on a landline, that'd be greater. But we hear you now.
Great. Well, go ahead and ask the next question if you like.
Okay, sure. Obviously, a lot of people were impressed with former President Clinton's presentation. Did it call anything to mind in your heart?
Now, look, you know, President Clinton served the country well for 8 years. He wasn't perfect. We have NAFTA and some of these other things that I think have probably damaged us. Certainly, he was a president with a fair plan, who basically had the same type of plan that President Obama wants to implement. And so, you know, I think it helped to change the battery a little bit. And, you know, I think his way of explaining things, obviously, I think that really touched a lot of people. I think it really aligned those who may not have been so engaged or motivated to get behind Barack Obama to do.
Well, I know that for this citizen, although I've been voting Democrat all my voting life, I always make a point of watching both conventions, Democrat and Republican alike. And I thought that it was such a refreshing change. Here we've got someone up at the podium who's actually discussing facts. And given the...
Shocking, huh?
given the dialogues we heard at the Tampa convention, it was absolutely refreshing. And of course, he also made sense, so there was that twin virtue.
Yeah, and, you know, look, the Republican convention was incredible theater. And what is it, the Emmys that are on tonight? I'm surprised there were nominations. You know, look, I think anytime you're in office, I certainly try to what I say, and I try to remain as factual as possible. And you know, they really threw it to the wind. I don't think there was any desire whatsoever to be factual. And you know, now we're looking at some polling that would, you know, say, look, we don't think you have the plan. You're not talking deep, and we want to move forward. And you know, I think I'm looking forward to November 6th. A lot can happen between now and then, and that's, you know, we have to be on for opportunities by Republicans to gain in the polls. But I think we're in pretty good shape today.
Well, you know, I thought it speaks so much to what kind of political leader Mr. Clinton was. You know, everybody who paid attention to the Tampa convention saw that speaker after speaker after speaker, when faced with the fact checkers, just failed miserably. And for him to actively take on a speech that was just jam-packed full of facts, knowing full well that every every fact checker in the universe was going to try to make some points by scoring on the Clinton speech. I thought it was remarkable. They couldn't come up with anything.
Yeah. Well, and two things I say, I think most, early on the day, the Democrats I did not support. And you always support the person. And one thing that Clinton, I think, really understands, wish more politicians did, is that really want, I think, two things from the people that represent them. They want to have an honest dialogue about what's going on, and want consistency. And you add two elements together, you blend them together, you get voters that at least feel as if they're being treated properly. You get the inconsistent votes on major issues. You know, in Florida, it could be from oil drilling to testing, people applying for emergency funds for their family. And then you listen to some of the I'll just say, garbage out of their mouths. It's no wonder people don't, want to show up to the polls. They don't want to support people. And you know, there's elected to basically ensure that those two qualities are part of who they are. And, hopefully that dialogue, if it doesn't, okay, you lose, you go home. And, there's always somebody who can do the job for you.
Well, the other thing, and I promised myself I wasn't going to take extra time to bash our good friends, the Republicans. But, when you start off with a premise like, we're not going to let our campaign be dictated to by fact checkers.
I think it really demonstrates how far away from reality some of these folks are. I mean, look, just go back to the Etch-a-Sketch. They're outlawed to the people that they expect for them, that we're just going to forget everything said and start over. How long do they? They just put it right out there. It's really shocking. But and that's the type of decision making that ends up with Sarah Palin and the riot. They don't care. And I think there is a segment of the population that is willing, unfortunately, to rally behind fiction and rally behind this nonsense that their mouths. I knocked on the door yesterday, actually, in Wellington, and the old man came to the door. We knew he was independent, and I think he was probably close to 80 years old, and there was nothing. He was a very, very conservative, admittedly conservative person who basically, about a failure and go, well. They're out there. Some people are just, hopefully a majority of people will understand that this is an important election and facts do matter. And in order to have a future, you've got to grow it by the horns. You've got to work. And your program and people who listen to the program. So many people out there that are on the right that work very, very hard. To me, optimistic in a state that isn't all that optimistic sometimes.
Yeah, that's for sure. Let me ask you this. You've been a campaigner now for several years. It would seem to me that someone who's in the campaign mode, I don't care what audience you're speaking to, candor to the extent where you're dissing a major portion of the electorate, you would think would be off the table. I'm referring to that 47% remark.
There was something comparing it to Thurston. The guy is just, I don't know, on the holiday season, they have one of these holiday shows with Chris Engel, and he ends up on an island with Misfit. Unfortunately, Misfit is a misfit. He may actually be a very nice guy, but he is just so out there. He doesn't understand certainly people that I represent. He doesn't understand me, you know, in terms of trying to pay bills and trying to live. And it's really shocking how dangerous that ignorance can be if he's affected. You know, I had a program today earlier where I talked about Medicaid in the state of Florida. You know, the fact that the state of Florida wants to continue our current system, you know, of Medicaid, where basically to apply for Medicaid, you have to be a parent, basically, the single parent of the child, making $3,500 or less a year. The fact that the state of Florida doesn't want to expand Medicaid and make people's lives better and ask people in this state who are some of the most wealthy in the nation to pay a little bit more through intangible taxes or coming up with real courageous decision-making where we're going to find new revenue, it just shows that there's indifference. It's a callous way to do things. And, you know, it's an important election. 2014 important because it's up. This one really sets the tone for 2014. We've got to get out there. We've got to beat these hurdles. They've been placed. So people like Democrats show up. It's going to be.
Mark, let me ask you, if you can get to a location that's a little more friendly for your cell phone, that'd be great if you could walk around a little bit, because right now you're, unfortunately, my friend, you're breaking up really bad. Let me ask you another question, you know. Here,
yep.
We've got a national candidate.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you sound a little better now, sir.
All right, I've stopped pacing. Go ahead.
You know, here we've got a guy who says to a Hispanic audience in Miami, you know, this would be a lot easier if he was Hispanic.
Yeah. I mean, it's shocking how they don't understand, talk to people. And that's what it comes down to. You know, there's a lot of people who just don't know how to have a conversation with, you know, people. And they're used to talking at a certain level. The whole Mitt Romney incident with the 47%, you know, he was talking in a very comfortable setting, and it ended up biting him in the rear. And thank God somebody videotaped it.
Well, you know, diplomacy skills, political skills are one thing, but you would think if only he felt a kinship, a solidarity with the promoters and producers of the Olympics, to go to Britain and say he didn't think these people could really pull it off. I mean, colossal insensitivity doesn't even come close.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, the thing is, if this were, you know, once or twice, but, I mean, he's continually doing this every few weeks. And unfortunately for him, you know, when he's opened his mouth in the last 2 to 3 weeks, it's really getting bad. Now, of course, you know, the videotape was, I think, back in May. But, you know, you listen to these guys and they just do not connect with the average person. And I think the average person realizes because they're not connecting, there's no way they can, you know, basically support what they want out of the United States, which is basically a fair shot. Which is basically building a middle class, you know, from the middle out rather than the top down. And I think people get that. People have a built-in, I'll say, BS meter. And I think, unfortunately for the Romney campaign, that ringer in a lot of people is going off, and it's quite loud.
Well, before we leave this segment, I do want to let you talk just a little bit about your campaign and what it is that you bring to the state of Florida. You know, you have this show's full and 100% support. Anything we can do for you, you've got it. But go ahead, speak to your audience and let them know what it is that you're going to do, how you're going to face this Tallahassee situation.
You know, I'm not going to do anything different. I'm not going to change who I am. You know, I've got a bit of a tighter district now in terms of makeup, you know, Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Independents make up almost 27% of my district. And I'm going to continue. I have faith that if you talk to people and you're honest and you're as I said, consistent about the issues that are important to them, whether it be public education. You'll notice I use the word public. Whether it's about, you know, as I said, oil drilling or not allowing poor kids, you know, who want a cupcake on their birthday to have it because the parent hasn't passed a drug test. I mean, it's real simple for me to be who I am in Tallahassee. And the reason for that is because basically the people that I represent, we have a good dialogue. And, you know, I just consider what every piece of legislation is going to be on some of my friends. And it's a real easy job. I just, you know, want a third term. I want to participate, make some things better in a place that right now, at least for 16 years, has been dominated in both the House, Senate, and the Mansion by Republicans. It, you know, not much of a campaign speech, but I do appreciate the opportunity to say hello to everybody.
Well, we sure appreciate you up there in Tallahassee working for the people. It's real distinct from the majority up there that's doing business for the corporations. Mark, well, it's been a real pleasure having you on, my friend.
Yeah, and I noticed you got a good lineup behind me. You got Susan Nylon and a number of other people down the list. So have a great show, and thank you. I do apologize for missing the last show, but I did prepare. I asked FPNL to supercharge my phone, so we're in good shape.
Well, thanks again, Mark, and best luck with your campaign, sir.
Hey, thank you. Have a great night.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That was candidate Mark Pafford, wonderful Florida representative Mark Pafford, a gentleman we'd like to see go back to Tallahassee and do the people's work, something that is just so critical since there's so many basically just terrible, terrible people up there working for the corporations. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put on this segment of the Brown and Warren debate until my next guest comes on. I know you're going to enjoy this. This is Elizabeth Warren debating Senator Brown for this next Senate race.
And this next question, you'll start, Ms. Warren.
Mm-hmm.
We learned today that the Massachusetts economy lost 4,800 jobs in August, and the unemployment rate is on the rise here. Gloria from Norwood submitted this question via CBSBoston.com. How and where will the most new jobs be created next year in Massachusetts, and what will you do in the Senate to spur their creation? 90 seconds.
Well, that's a really great question because jobs is a central issue here. And I think the answer is we have to have both a long-term plan for jobs, which has to do with leveling the playing field so that small businesses have a chance to compete and really get out there and create jobs. But in the short run, we also have work that needs to be done and people who need those jobs. So my view is we should put them to work. That's why I was so surprised when Senator Brown last fall voted against three jobs bills in a row. Jobs bills that would have put 22,000 people to, supported 22,000 jobs here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. A jobs bill that would have prevented the layoffs of teachers, firefighters, and police officers all across the Commonwealth. And a jobs bill that would have put 11,000, supported 11,000 jobs, mostly in construction here in Massachusetts, which has been particularly hard hit. You know, we put into jobs bills, we get work done that needs to be done, and that's how we get this economy jump-started. We get people back to work. Those families have paychecks. Those small businesses see more customers coming in. That's how it works. I want to go to Washington to fight for jobs.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, 90 seconds, new jobs in the Commonwealth.
Thank you, John. Appreciate the question. As you know, I've been down there working on jobs, and the three jobs bills that she refers to, with all due respect, would have raised your taxes $450 billion. And it was a bipartisan rejection, political votes put up just to score points so you could talk about it today. And they were rejected by both Democrats and Republicans because they recognized that taking more money out of hard-working businesses and individuals and giving it to the federal government is not a good idea, and I'm not going to be part of that. The jobs bills that I have been working on, John, are very clear. As you know, we passed a bill, the 3% withholding, which was a stealth tax going into effect that would have affected our contractors who are doing work with the federal government. That's gone as a result of my efforts. Excuse me. The new crowdfunding piece of legislation that passed is a new way to actually create jobs. I was over at the Cambridge Innovation Center the other day and saw the new opportunities to create up to $1 million, raise $1 million online, and actually have investors and take that money and parlay it into more and more opportunities for our job creators. The only parts of the president's jobs bill that passed were mine. And as a result of that, we also did, if you remember, the third vote. I know you commented on it. The third vote that I actually took was a jobs bill that got money out the door. And we did it without raising taxes. And that's the key. Professor Warren's proposals, according to the National Federation of Independent Businesses, her tax proposals, taking more money out of your pocketbooks and wallets, would cut 700,000 jobs nationwide.
Okay.
And I'm not going to stand for that.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
So let's talk about those three jobs bills. You know, I just met last week with Richard from Leominster. He's a carpenter, and he's talked about what it's meant, how spotty work has been. Sometimes there's work, and a lot of times there's not. Those were three jobs bills that would have supported jobs here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And how would they be paid for? They would have been paid for by just a fractional tax on people making more than $1 million a year. These were fully paid for jobs bills, and that's what I really don't understand. When I talk to people here in the Commonwealth who are really struggling, I don't understand how Senator Brown could vote against one jobs bill, another one to protect teachers, firefighters, police officers, and a third one for construction workers. We can put people back to work. We have work that needs to be done. But Senator Brown is lining up with the Republicans to vote no.
Let's get a response.
Well, first of all, John, thank you. Maybe you should tell Richard that the reason that he is not working is because we have this lack of regulatory and tax certainty, and that businesses and individuals are scared right now because of your policies of raising up to $3.4 trillion on the backs of our hardworking citizens. And that's something that the people watching are going to have to pay for. As I said, the National Federation of Independent Businesses said her policies would cut 700,000 jobs, 17,000 here in Massachusetts. And the criticism that you're hearing from Professor Warren and her supporters is that I don't want to raise taxes. Guilty as charged. I'm not going to raise taxes. I'm going to protect the pocketbooks and wallets of everybody listening. If you want someone who's going to spend your tax dollars, give it to Professor Warren. She'll spend them.
Ms. Warren.
So I just want to be clear about this tax number that the senator has come up with. It's just not real. And he's just made up these numbers. But what I do know, now that the senator has raised the question of taxes, is that the senator has voted to let taxes go up on hard-working families. You know, just what's it been, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a bill in the United States Senate, and what it would do is extend tax cuts for 98% of the families here in Massachusetts and 97% of small businesses. And Senator Brown voted no. Now, why did he vote no? Because there weren't enough tax breaks for the top 2% and the top 3%. For me, this is just an example of whose side do you stand on? Are you holding out? Are you hanging in there for the top 2%? Or are you there to fight for working people?
And that was an excerpt of the debate between Elizabeth Warren and Senator Brown in Massachusetts. These are important issues that you should hear about. Next up, our correspondent Susan Nylon, who's going to report from her experience at the Republican convention, then make a few comments about the Democratic convention. This is Susan Nylon of the Susan Nylon Report. Thank you so much for joining me.
Sure.
Let's start with the Republican convention. If you could characterize an overall impression of that convention, what would you say?
You know, my first impression of the RNC was that it was less about the candidate and more about a referendum against the president. What I found kind of funny is we had several different vantage points when we were at the RNC, on top of being on the floor and then being able to go freely behind the scenes. We also had a bird's eye view because they put radio at the very, very top of the forum. In fact, we had to take a service elevator with all the garbage and trash cans and squeeze in between them to get up to our radio nest. So we really were up in the rafters. So what I saw is several different things throughout my experience at the RNC. number one, as I said originally, that it was more of a referendum against the current administration and the presidency than it was actually about, you know, their candidate Romney. I found several things that happened. Number one, in general, there was a lot of chatter that went on, irregardless of what happened on the stage. It wasn't until actually, you know, Mitt Romney came out or Clint Eastwood came out that people started really paying attention. Between then, it was just conversations that were constantly going on that we were able to hear all the way up in the rafters. So we thought that was a little funny at first. The other things that were happening was a lot of infighting that went on at the RNC between the different groups, especially with what happened with the people that were there in support of Ron Paul. I don't know how many people caught what was going on, but in the very beginning when the RNC first opened up and Reince Priebus gaveled in the convention on Tuesday, not on Monday. Monday he gaveled in and gaveled out because of the storms. But on Tuesday when it officially started, there was a lot of back business that was going on, rules that were being changed that greatly affected the Republican Party. And there was also some shenanigans going on. In fact, the first thing I noticed, I was sitting on the floor, he came on stage and, you know, they did the pledge, they did a few announcements, and I looked around and I said to one of my reporters, I said, this place is half empty. And I was shocked. I took photos of it to say, where are all the people? Why aren't they here? Where is their participation? And as the day went on, you know, rule changes had been made. They had voted in. Some things had happened that I personally was shocked that it was happening. And yet there wasn't that many people there to witness it. So what we found out initially, we found out around 4 o'clock that someone had forgotten to order the buses to bring the delegates in, that they were somehow stranded somewhere. And I thought to myself, that's not a really odd, because that's something pretty major. You just don't forget to order the buses to bring the delegates in, because they're all housed at different hotels around the area. Most of them have flown in. And each of those destinations have meetings that they go to. So it's not like they all are with their cars. So that was the first reason that we were given why they weren't there. They came in around 4 or 5 o'clock for the evening festivities. Then the second day, we heard that not only were they delayed by several hours, but that once the buses picked the delegates up, I think about 3 or 4 buses actually drove around the city for over an hour, not letting the delegates out during that time of all those votes. So people got off the bus really angry that they weren't allowed to participate. And it started to seem like there was more of a conspiracy going on than it was just some kind of natural thing. So when the people finally got off the bus and realized that they had missed some very important votes on the changes in the Republican Party, there was a lot of anger. And unfortunately, a lot of those people were people who were there to support Ron Paul, who, you know, as of 9 o'clock the night before, had every right to be voted in for the pick. But by the time that the rules were changed the next day, you know, for example, the Republican Party, when a candidate has won five states, he's allowed to come to the floor and a vote can be taken. Well, that morning that those delegates were kept from the floor, it went from 5 states to 8 states, which is, you know, Ron Paul had 5 states. I think he might have even had 6 states. But when they changed the rule, it was no longer. On top of the fact that they've also changed the way the party is handled in the future, meaning that how delegates are gathered are tremendously changed. So without going into detail about that, there was a lot of animosity, a lot of anger. Things happened on the floor that, you know, were surprising. They really did their best effort to suppress all the Ron Paul supporters in subtle ways, and then again some not so subtle ways. So they had that build up. It took them probably about 2 days to overcome those issues, to the point where Ron Paul people were just walking out, which is really what they wanted.
But it seems like an odd way to engender oneself to the independent spirited people.
They don't want that. That's the whole point. They don't want an independent spirit. They want to have control. They want to have the appearance of party unification, which is why they worked so hard at keeping the Ron Paul people quiet. Unlike at the Democratic National Convention, where everyone there was behind a single candidate and the enthusiasm was where it should be, they didn't have that at the RNC. And the first thing they wanted to do is give the appearance that they did.
A little something about the platform. You know, we don't hear too much about Romney policies. The way they address foreign policy, the title of that chapter is American Exceptionalism. It's an odd way to open the topic of foreign affairs.
Well, I mean, foreign policy is not his strong suit, and, you know, the Republican Party itself, I mean, let's just be honest, John Bolton was all over the RNC, and he's got a heavy hand in the foreign policy. So what they've essentially done, at least in my opinion, from the Romney campaign, is because they don't really have any strong individual viewpoints of their own, they basically have taken John Bolton's information from the Bush era and have used it, and then you know, don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it. I mean, he's just not good at foreign policy. He's certainly not good at diplomacy because he regularly puts his foot in his mouth and is not really concerned, or is not. I think he's just not used to offending people, because when you are on such a pedestal, even when you do offend someone, they're less likely to tell you in fear of being alienated from, you know, from the inner circle. So he's always caught by surprise when he puts his foot in his mouth and doesn't understand why people are reacting that way. But, and then again, there's an arrogance that is wrapped around Mitt Romney and the Republican Party on, you know, how they should be first. And they should be first because they're entitled to be first.
Your overall impression, you did an overall impression of the Republican convention. What is your overall take on the Democratic convention?
Well, you know, my overall impression of the DNC is it's totally enthusiastic, different atmosphere, different, you know, mentality. They have known from 4 years ago that they were going to support this candidate. So to them, it was more exciting to be there. There wasn't as much controversy. It was just really, you know, how are we going to get from this day to November 6th, and what are we going to do to get there? So it was truly like going to a big party that your friends are throwing, as opposed to, you know, is this going to happen or is that going to happen? You know, he's a candidate, but he's just basically occupying the space. It's really, we're pushing forward. You know, like you felt at the RNC. There's a lot of enthusiasm. Also, I think the difference is, and I do want to note, too, that, you know, not a lot of people realize that the protesters at the RNC, you were truly in a bunker, and it was similar, not as dramatic, but as similar at the DNC, where all the people that were actually protesting were kept so far away from the people at the convention. And the fact that you had to go through so many checkpoints that when you were inside, you never wanted to leave because it was such a pain to get back in. So you were really isolated. The difference, I believe, between the protesting at the RNC to the protesting in Charlotte is the protesting was more of a reminder to not forget the promises that were made, as opposed to people that were really, really angry. I mean, and also the weather made a big difference as well. The Occupy people were scheduled in when they were in Tampa to have their major protest on the day that everything was canceled, which was Monday. So when it came to Charlotte, they had a very big protest, but the weather did not interfere with their plans.
And thanks for mentioning our good friends out there in those segregated, isolated, free speech zone miles from anything that's important.
Yes.
Because that's the way we practice democracy nowadays, evidently.
It is. It is. And you know, you got to remember, most of the people that arrived were bused in. So there was really no sense of connection.
Right. Well, there's a variety of reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Susan. This is Susan Nylon of the Sarasota Radio Talk Show. Is it the Nylon Report, Susan?
It's the Nylon Report on WSRQ Radio.
And they can also hear you online?
Yep, at sarasotatalkradio.com.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Susan. I appreciate your input always. Thanks again.
You're welcome, Rick. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes, that was Susan Nylon of the Nylon Report. We should have some more live guests on in just a minute. I do want to thank my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce, and horror organization, Media Goddess Worldwide, and also Imagineering Productions, who sponsor these shows every week. Without their support, these shows couldn't go on. I hope you'll consider. If you need media support, you contact Media Goddess Worldwide. And, of course, if you need multimedia or SEO services or web media, you'll consider Imagineering Productions and support the people that support the shows. And also, while we're talking about support, I do also want to mention our good friends in the progressive broadcast community, the charming, talented, intelligent, and creative Miss Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, the very talented and perceptive Brian Stettin, whose show, Progress Toward Democracy, can be heard on Monday nights and Friday nights, and also, of course, Susan Nylon and her show. And one of our guests coming up in just a few minutes, Rob Abston, is going to be starting a show himself on the air. So make sure you support these other good progressive activists. A couple events that I didn't quite get to yet. I do also want to mention that, okay, let's see, we got through that. Oh, yes, Three Mile Island has been acting up again. The reactor at Three Mile Island, the site of the nation's worst nuclear accident, was shut down unexpectedly on Thursday when a coolant pump tripped and steam was released. But, of course, they're assuring us that everything's okay. And the plant responded as designed and was stable with no impact on public health or safety, added the NRC spokeswoman, Diane Ceresi. Any radiation that was released in the steam, well, it must have been below detectable levels because we didn't detect it. Exelon, the plant's operator, said in a statement that during the shutdown, steam was released into the atmosphere, creating a loud noise heard by nearby residents. An NRC inspector based at the plant responded to the control room immediately when the reactor tripped, and he independently inserted control over the control operator's response to the event, and he ensured safety systems were functioning as designed. He did not identify any immediate concerns with the operations and performance. And don't forget, in addition to Equinox today, this is also Fuel the Future with Clean Energy. Join the Global Frackdown. This is Global Frackdown Day. If you want more information, go to globalfrackdown.org. That's GlobalFrackDown, Frackdown. Globalfrackdown.org. And that's today. Okay, we've got some excerpts that we want to play you of the Democratic Convention also to get you geared up. So let me go ahead and play the our Democratic excerpts. There we go.
We are here to nominate a president. And I've got one in mind. I want to nominate a man whose own life has known its fair share of adversity and uncertainty. I want to nominate a man who ran for president to change the course of an already weak economy, and then just 6 weeks before his election, saw it suffer the biggest collapse since the Great Depression. A man who stopped the slide into depression and put us on the long road to recovery, knowing all the while, no matter how many jobs that he saved or created, there'd still be millions more waiting, worried about feeding their own kids, trying to keep their hopes alive. I want to nominate a man who's cool on the outside. But who burns for America on the inside. I want a man who believes with no doubt that we can build a new American dream economy driven by innovation and creativity, by education and, yes, by cooperation. And by the way, after last night, I want a man who had the good sense to marry Michelle Obama. Well, vote for Barack Obama to be the next president of the United States. And I proudly nominate him to be the standard bearer of the Democratic Party. Now, folks, in Tampa a few days ago, we heard a lot of talk. All about how the president and the Democrats don't really believe in free enterprise and individual initiative. How we want everybody to be dependent on the government. How bad we are for the economy. This Republican narrative, this alternative universe, says that every one of us in this room who amounts to anything, we're all completely self-made. One of the greatest chairmen the Democratic Party ever had, Bob Strauss, used to say that every politician wants every voter to believe he was born in a log cabin he built himself. But, as Strauss then admitted, it ain't so. We Democrats, we think the country works better with a strong middle class, with real opportunities for poor folks to work their way into it, with a relentless focus on the future, with business and government actually working together to promote growth and broadly shared prosperity. You see, we believe that we're all in this together is a far better philosophy than you're on your own. We all know that he also tried to work with congressional Republicans on health care, debt reduction, and new jobs. And that didn't work out so well. But it could have been because, as the Senate Republican leader said in a remarkable moment of candor, 2 full years before the election, their number one priority was not to put America back to work. It was to put the president out of work. In Tampa, the Republican argument against the president re-election was actually pretty simple, pretty snappy. It went something like this. We left him a total mess. He hadn't cleaned it up fast enough, so fire him and put us back in. My fellow Americans, all of us in this grand hall and everybody watching at home, when we vote in this election, we'll be deciding what kind of country we want to live in. If you want a winner-take-all, your own, your own society, you should support the Republican ticket. But if you want a country of shared opportunities and shared responsibility, a we're-all-in-this-together society, you should vote for Barack Obama and Joe Biden. If you want... if you want America, if you want every American to vote, and you think it is wrong to change voting procedures, just to reduce the turnout of younger, poorer, minority, and disabled voters, you should support Barack Obama. If you think the president was right to open the doors of American opportunity to all those young immigrants brought here when they were young so they can serve in the military or go to college, you must vote for Barack Obama. If you want a future of shared prosperity, where the middle class is growing and poverty is declining, where the American dream is really alive and well again, and where the United States maintains its leadership as a force for peace and justice and prosperity in this highly competitive world, you have to vote for Barack Obama. Look.
So that was Bill Clinton excerpts from the Democratic Convention. I'm sure many of you caught it. He certainly did a heck of a good job establishing a good logical set of facts and reasons why Democrats should be supporting our current president. And somebody just commented in the text message arena, yes, Bill sounded a little raspy. I think his speechifying throat is has seen better days, but isn't that true for so many of us? Another event that I want to get to before we get our next caller in, I want to mention that on October 27th, Realpolitik, which is a series of political films that's being shown. This is down in Boca Raton on the East Coast. At 6:15 on October 27th, Realpolitik is presenting the Koch Brothers Exposed. And there's a special appearance by the singing group Pink Slip. And there'll be a discussion after the showing of the film. Discussions will be hosted by yours truly, news director Rick Spezak. And there's a $5 donation recommended. So I'm going to now go ahead and play this little excerpt of the Republican excerpts, some excerpts from the Republican convention. And this is Ann Romney and Paul Ryan.
I want to talk to you about the deep and abiding love I have for a man I met at a dance many years ago. And the profound love I have, and I know we share, for this country. I want to talk to you about that love.
Hold on one second right there, Ann. We'll be getting back to you. My next guest just appeared. I think we have Miss Susan Smith. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy Sunday. Happy 44 days out from the election.
Happy 44. Happy equinox. Absolutely.
Yeah, lots to
How are you, Susan? Are you rested up from your travels?
I think I'm rested up. We've had a busy weekend. We had our big dinner last night with Mayor Cory Booker, who's not my favorite on education policy, but he's great on the other issues, and he was just a phenomenal speaker. If you haven't heard him speak before, you really need to make a point to do it, because he had the room on fire. It was great. And
well,
then we had a fundraiser today over in St. Pete for Ian Whitney, who's a member of our progressive caucus, who's running for the state house down there in District 120. So if anybody can support Ian, we'd love to have you do it. We've got lots of good progressive candidates around the state.
Getting more and more all the time. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell you, we appreciate all the good work that you're doing with the caucus.
Thank you. Thank you. And all the good work you're doing down in South Florida is much appreciated also, Rick.
Well, you know, Susan, tonight's topic is unconventional conventions. And I wanted to get your sense. Did you get by the Republican convention at all?
No, I actually left town for it. I was driving up to Charlotte, and I have family not too far from Charlotte, so I decided to go up before the convention. So I spent my time in East Tennessee with Republican relatives watching the convention. Although they're pretty non-political, so they weren't. I was paying attention; they really weren't. So it was fine. It wasn't bad at all to watch it. The most amazing was Clint Eastwood. I just couldn't. I mean, I couldn't even believe it, actually, when I was watching it.
Susan, let me ask you this. You know, you're a person who's done a lot of thinking about politics, a lot of thinking about campaigns, how one frames political speech. What was your take? What were they thinking putting on an actor before Mitt? And what was your thinking of their plan? And then, of course, what did you think about how it went?
Well, of course, it was pretty appalling. It went really well for our side, but not so well for his. I don't know. I think the whole thing was very badly managed. You know, just from other accounts I've heard from people who aren't so political who watched both, they could tell a distinct difference between the level of energy, the organizational, just the whole kind of show production between the Republicans and the Democrats. And I think that was just, we've seen so many missteps from this campaign, it's hard to believe that they've still got, I forget the guy's name, is it Steve something who's managing the campaign? I think Maureen Dowd wrote about him today in a pretty funny column. You know, he's just not, he's not getting the job done, and I don't think it says a lot for Romney's managerial skills to have somebody like him running the campaign. You know, Romney is on top of the heap there, and, you know, the responsibility really stops with him, and I don't think he's got a very good team working for him.
Well, you know, I mean, I thought that Sarah Palin showed that you couldn't put a dummy out there and expect to talk through her mouth. Clearly, Mitt seems to have a real taste for foot and mouth. Hardly a day goes by when there's not some new gaffe. I mean, whether he's declaring it'd be easier to run if he was a Hispanic in Miami, to insulting the Britons with their showcase in the Olympics. You know, this guy really has an interesting way of expressing himself.
Well, you know, I think he's just not, I don't think he likes this. I don't think he really knows why he wanted to be president except to be president. I don't think they have a clue what's involved. Somebody said a while ago on Facebook under, you know, they were making a comment about Ann Romney and her remarks this week about how hard it was to run. And somebody said, if you think it's hard running for president, you ought to wait till to see what it's like to actually, not that it's going to happen, because I don't think it will, but, you know, this is nothing compared to what it's like to actually be president. So I don't think he's ready for it. I don't think he really wants it except to have the title. I don't think he's comfortable with it, and I think it shows. I think he's gotten worse as the campaign's gone along. I think it'll be really interesting to compare the Mitt Romney of last year during the debates, the Republican debates, to the Mitt Romney who's going to be debating President Obama, because I think it'll be a distinct difference in his comfort level and how well he handles himself, because I just don't see that. He's not getting better at it.
Well, it seemed he was certainly comfortable in that fundraiser in Boca Raton.
Oh, yeah, those were his people, for sure. So I guess that's... people did remark on that, too, how much more relaxed and how easy the words came, and he didn't stumble all over himself. So I think there is a comfort level when he's in the room with a bunch of rich people, he's just not comfortable in front of the other 47%.
Well, you know, I don't know if you had a chance to hear Susan Nylon's comments early on. She was on site at the Republican convention. She made a point of talking about how it seems that a lot of the convention attendees were basically kept, prevented from attending so they could rush through these anti-Ron Paul measures and change the rules, you know, in mid-flight there, and basically to lock out any chance of a vote for Ron Paul or any floor activity for Ron Paul. I mean, I remember conventions when I was growing up where you had, you know, the favorite son being nominated. I don't know. I thought that was democratic process where you had different nominees and there was a vote. And of course, I guess the Republicans have showed us once again, they're not that much in favor of democratic processes.
Right. Well, neither are the Democrats anymore. I think we've all gotten away from it and we've found a different way to settle things, you know, with the primaries. So it's all a done deal before the conventions. And I know there was a lot of discussion about the value of having conventions, you know, especially after the RNC. I don't think we heard quite as much of it after the DNC because of the energy level and the, you know, the whole atmosphere there was so different. I wasn't at the RNC, but I know what it was like in Charlotte, and it was beyond what I was expecting. You know, I was out in Denver, 'cause you were too. I was not a delegate out there, but I was involved in the peripheral, you know, the activities that were going on around town, and I thought this couldn't be any better than what it felt like out there, and it was, I think it was every bit as exciting for the delegates and for the people who attended as it was out in Denver 4 years ago. So I think I heard Susan's comments. I was glad to hear them because I kind of missed out on a lot of that the backstory of the convention. So I was glad to, I mean, I was interested to hear what she had to say, and I don't think I was really aware of that, and I'm not sure the media covered it quite to the extent that she
well,
did. The national media, I didn't hear that so much. But I did like, you know, having MSNBC. It's such a valuable resource for us when these things happen, because in Charlotte, you know, the parties go on till 2:30 in the morning, and we didn't make it that long at parties, but just when you come back to your hotel at the end of the night, it's midnight or 12:30, and you have to get something to eat. And, you know, we wouldn't get to our room till 2 or 2:30. And then we were up at 6 because we didn't want to miss the coverage, because we had kind of missed what the coverage was, you know, during the actual event and all the follow-up. So we couldn't wait to get up the next morning at 6 to hear what they were saying about it. So well, it was all very exciting.
You're right. The in-person experience of a convention versus the overview that you get from a decent quality news team, it's really different. The on-the-floor experience is so different, and you get a whole different kind of information. But I was wondering, the tenor, the vibration, if you will, of the audience in Tampa versus Charlotte, I heard happy crowd sounds in Charlotte. I didn't seem to hear that happy crowd sound in Tampa. I heard angry crowd sounds. Did you get that same experience?
You know, I didn't really – I can't really comment on what happened at the RNC, but I am the world's worst and most impatient person during speeches, because most of the speeches I've heard so many times by the time we get to this part of a cycle, you know, because I'm a news junkie and I attend so many events. So I was thinking, oh, I'll take my iPad, you know, I'm going to be sitting there for 6 hours at least every day, and I'll get a lot of reading done. And I was out of my seat applauding literally every other minute. We were up and down and up and down, and they do all this choreography with the signs, you know, because they give you the signs, and you have these, they're called whips, who wear vests, who and they're from our delegation, people we know, and they're walking the aisles, handing us the signs, telling us when to hold the signs up, and, you know, people are getting excited and holding the signs up when they're not supposed to, and you, so you're up and down, literally. I think I probably, you know, got more exercise in Charlotte than I've gotten in a long time, just being able to be in there for all the excitement, and it really was. I mean, the night that who was it, you that mentioned Deval Patrick, or was it Mark? I think it was Mark Pafford. I was listening to his segment too. And that night, Ted Strickland was amazing. And Deval Patrick was great. And, you know, it was just, it was like an electricity in the air. And I'm a pretty jaded, cynical person. And I was on my feet yelling and screaming. And, you know, it was just a really, it was such an honor to have been elected by the people from Congressional District 9 who elected me to go, and I really, you know, just want to say thank you for the experience, because it really was something very special to be there.
If you could sum up the whole experience of Charlotte in just a couple sentences, what would you say? What was your overall impression of Charlotte?
Excitement. I think kind of a re-energized feeling. You know, a lot of us have, on the progressive side, have been disappointed because we haven't gotten a lot of the things that we thought would be accomplished. They just haven't been accomplished. So I think a lot of us have been not the most excited Democrats for the last couple of years. But to be there, especially after the RNC, when you heard what the speeches were about and you know what they have in store if they were to win again, and then to go into that situation where you remember what it was like and you remember that feeling. I mean, it's like, I think a good way to think of it is when Clinton and Gore came out on the stage to Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Do you remember that feeling back in 1992? How
sure.
It just
sure.
felt like it was a new day, and we had that feeling again in Charlotte, I think. And that wasn't two sentences. It was a lot more, but it really did feel that way. And Charlotte was a lovely city, and the people could not have been nicer and more hospitable. And there were police everywhere, but there was never a threatening tone. And do you remember in Denver they had, like, people in riot gear?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Marching in the streets, like,
uh-huh.
Very threatening. There was none of that at this convention. I mean, there was a huge presence of police, but they were so nice and so friendly. And they had volunteers on every corner offering to help us find what we were looking for. And it was a really impressive city. And we saw the light rail that was supposed to have been Tampa's. I just want to throw that out there, too. It would have been really nice. Back in the... I'm not sure when it happened. It was when Rhonda Storms, we all know her, was on our county commission, and there was an opportunity for matching funds for light rail in Tampa, and we turned it down because Rhonda Storms led the opposition to it. So the light rail we should have gotten is now in Charlotte. So anyway,
let me ask you about one other thing. Did
mm-hmm.
you see any of the protesters?
Yes, I was there on Sunday when they had the big parade protest.
Uh-huh.
I took some pictures. It looked like a protest we would have all been a part of because they were protesting the same things we protest.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were protesting the Democratic Party as such. They were protesting, you know, the 1%. They were protesting for the Dream Act and for, you know, immigration rights and for farm worker rights and for women's rights and LGBT rights and the things that we do normally they were doing. If I'd gotten in town a little earlier and known the details, I probably would have joined them. And then there were a couple of other times there were small pockets of, I know there were some Dreamers or some immigration people out another day in the street. But, you know, there was no, I didn't see any kind of hostility from the police or anything. And they were literally right in the middle of where we were. So I don't think there was quite the area of separation and segregation that they had here in Tampa.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to hear. Absolutely. Well, Susan, I sure
anyway,
appreciate...
it was wonderful.
Is there anything else you want to mention about either the campaign or about things people should think about between now and the voting day?
Well, you know, there are some very important amendments on the ballot. We have to, I don't know if your show has covered those, but there are 11 constitutional amendments on our ballot. The Progressive Caucus has taken positions on them, and we hope everybody will take a look at our positions. I don't know if you have a minute for me to go over those, but that's on our website, Progressive Dem Caucus, FL, I think is what it is, .org. And we've been handing out bookmarks with our recommendations all over the state. We're going to be ordering another batch, I think, soon. Also, the retention of the 3 Supreme Court judges. It's vitally
right.
important that we retain those 3 judges. And then we have some targeted races around the state. We need 3 Senate seats in order to be able to stop Rick Scott and the Republicans. We can end their supermajority if we get back 3 Senate seats, and that would be Maria Sachs' seat. The best chances for pickups, Maria Sachs, Darren Soto and Frank Bruno, those 3 seats. And then we know there are several House seats, Ian Whitney's seat down in 120, Karen Castor Dental in the Orlando area. We have, there are, I think, 3 potential pickups in, or one would be Rick Kreisman's seat, Josh Shulman I met today. We've got a chance to hold on to that seat. And then Mary Jo Ambrose and Dwight Dudley, and then Gail Gottlieb here in Tampa. And I'm sure there are some others. Nancy Soderbergh's running for the Senate up in the Jacksonville area. We need to get that information out to people, because if we could just pick up a handful in each house, we can stop these evil you-know-whats from,
yep.
from the worst of the worst. And either Rick Scott's going to go for broke, when he goes back, or he's going to be playing it safe and try to veto some things because he wants to run for governor again. So the legislature might try to override anything he does. So it's really important for us to pick up those three seats we need and to hold on to all of our incumbents, like Mark Pafford, who's such a champion, Dwight Bullard, who's such a champion for us. I mean, we've got
Susan,
a real champion.
Susan, let me ask you.
I'm sorry, I'm going way
over. I was just
going
to say, would you like to, can you stick around and stay for the panel at 8:30, or do you want to call back in?
You know, I might be able to call back in. I'll see if I can. I've
kind of
got
some other things, I understand.
Yeah, in a crucial spot. So anyway, it's been great being on, and I'd love to come back and talk about some of these races. Maybe as we get a little closer, we could do a show taped if we can't make
Absolutely.
It work, whatever you'd like to do.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks for having me, and everybody get out there. Vote by mail, vote by mail, vote by mail, and vote down the ballot, all the way down to the end.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Okay, thanks, Rick.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we've got our next guest, Ms. Meredith Achman. Meredith, welcome.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you so much for having me back. I always love coming on the show.
Well, listen, we're talking about our unconventional convention coverage. I was wondering if you could give us some of your thoughts. Did you have a chance to watch any of the Republican convention?
I certainly did. And I also watched the Republican convention. I watched the Democrat convention. Well, first I want to say, I'm speaking as Meredith today. I'm not only speaking, I have roles in organizations and stuff. And
I understand
and I know usually
completely.
Usually I come on for those purposes, but I think there's a few things that I definitely, that I might say that might cross some of those boundaries that those organizations are not allowed to cross.
You're on as a wise political advisor tonight, not wearing any of your other professional hats.
Thank you. I just ran in so I didn't get a chance to hear the entire rest of the show. Of course, I'll be listening to it when I as soon as the broadcast is over. But Susan Smith is always so brilliant, and I'm so glad that she brought up the issue of the Supreme Court justices. They really protect our people from the people of Florida from a lot of really egregious and self-serving things that some of the conservatives make attempts at. So she's very wise. I'm glad that you brought that up.
Let's not hand those decisions over to Scott, huh?
Right, and that's just it. Like, one of the things that people aren't necessarily as conscious of from in the general population is that if those Supreme Court justices, who are actually really good justices and fairly progressive, if they don't end up back for another session, those decisions go to Rick Scott to make a recommendation as to who gets to take their place. And I don't want any more decisions in his hands than are absolutely necessary.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you this. Conventions are concerned.
Go ahead.
When you asked me to come on, you had mentioned something that you were going to be talking about the conventions, and I was trying to narrow it down and organize how I was going to talk about it, and I think it came down to three things that are the primary issues that I thought were very different between the two. The first thing was the platforms were obviously a very interesting telling way that we can look at both sides at each side. I think the second one was the list of speakers that they had. And the third one that I thought was interesting was the diversity in populations or lack thereof.
Right.
So when you talk about the platforms, I mean, let's start there. I mean, so the Republican platform, basically, I haven't seen a lot of legislation outside of abortion rights that chooses to attempt to take rights away from people, except when you're talking about abortion or when you're talking about the LGBT community. And essentially, the platform on the Republican side aims to do exactly that. They want the government to have access to your uterus and they want the government to have access to your doctor's office and to your bedroom. And this is supposed to be the party of smaller government, and yet it's completely clear to me that they don't think women in particular, but people are capable of making family planning decisions on their own, and so they think that the government should step in, and that costs a lot of money too. So even for your more conservative fan base, the finances that go into having the government make those decisions is a big challenge. So I thought that was fascinating. No equal marriage rights for the LGBT community. And it seems as though the Republicans want to bring back don't ask, don't tell. They want to bring back, some of the more restrictive goals that the Obama administration had met. They want to bring back some of those things from yesteryear. And it's fascinating to me because it almost seemed like while we were watching the debates over the platforms, like the Republican platform could have been taking place in the 1970s, 80s. It was fascinating to me. On the Democrat side, I think it was also telling, as far as the platforms are concerned, because the Democrats were specifically speaking, even when you speak about, when you consider the Israel issue and how much of a wedge issue that would have been, you know, they were trying to be more inclusive when they created the platform, and instead it showed a lot of character in our president to make sure that Jerusalem being the capital of Israel was kept in the platform and that was maintained, and I thought that showed a lot of character on his part.
You know, Go ahead. I was going to say, when Susan Nylon was on, she actually attended the Republican convention, and she mentioned how Bolton's hands, his fingerprints, were all over the foreign policy. And I thought it was amazing to me that we heard so little, and we continue to hear so little, from the Romney team about what their plans are for foreign policy, when we're in a country that's in war in so many places across the globe, where these people seem to think that we're still not armed enough, even though we're the most heavily armed nation in the world. And, while they're on the one hand prepared to criticize every action of the current administration, they haven't said anything much more other than that we're going to arm. And when you think how scary it would be to have John Bolton's hands on foreign policy, I just find it very, very, very troubling.
Oh, absolutely. And it's plain to see that their side doesn't really have a plan for foreign policy. That's why they haven't advertised it. You know, if there was education on that side of the ticket, then they would probably have advertised something. But I honestly don't believe that they know anything about foreign policy. I mean, we might as well have Sarah Palin still sitting there, because it's almost as bad. The difference is that they have people on that ticket who should have known, who should know it, because they've been running our government, and they don't. So, that's a huge, huge challenge. So the next piece that I thought was really interesting was the list of the speakers. So I really felt like the conservatives with the Republican convention had a fairly disingenuous list of speakers. It wasn't organic for those people that they brought out to speak. They weren't people who are regularly in the spotlight. They brought out women from all over the place, but they didn't bring out women who regularly work on the issues of women's rights, who regularly are conscious of what we deal with and what women go through. And, when you watch the Democrat convention, it was abundantly clear that the people who were speaking were people who always speak. It's not, we didn't really get surprised with a lot of new faces, but a lot of them were women who were brought in by the administration or who continue to do the work all over the country. And I felt like, here's the thing. We know that women are a big voting bloc in this state, in the country. What we don't need is a party that chooses to attempt to solely cater to the rhetoric as opposed to what's genuinely important to women. And so when they bring out somebody who happens to be a woman, and think that that's going to make it so that we think that their party is doing right by women is completely disingenuous and transparent. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what I saw when I saw these conventions. We saw the people who really genuinely do, you know, on the Democrat side, we saw that these are women who are actively involved and who are constantly involved. But if you look at President Obama's, at his cabinet, you see women who have taken, you know, who he's given leadership roles to because they're qualified, because they're smart, and because they can do the job. And I was so sad to not get to see Hillary Clinton at the convention, but I'm glad that her work in other places was done because it needed to be done.
Excellent. Thank you, Meredith. Let me bring on Louis. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say I need to bring on Louis Cuevas for him to give us a few minutes of his take, and then we'll have the whole panel together and we'll discuss it, okay?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you so much for the insight that you gave us for the conventions, and that was very thoughtful of you to prepare that comparison even before you came on the show. Thanks again. Yeah, let me bring on Louis Cuevas. Louis, welcome.
Hey, how are you, brother?
Very good, my friend, very good.
Excellent.
I'm so glad you could join us tonight for this discussion of the unconventional take on the conventions. We've got Meredith here on the side, and Rob Avison will be on in just a few minutes. But, sir, I was wondering if you could give us your take, just kind of a general thumb sketch on both of the conventions. What was your walkaway, what was your takeaway from the Republican convention?
And the Republican convention, I call it the hate fest. essentially, you have a convergence of all these individuals who have nothing else to express but contempt and hatred for the majority of the people. Essentially, it all boils down to that. How are we going to help we the people, which translates to the corporations, and that's that's essentially what they mean by that. People say, "Well, why aren't they going against the corporations, saying like that?" Well, it's a common thing that a dog won't bite the hands that feeds them. And that's what happens. And here are the corporations behind the whole thing. This is all orchestrated on the Republican side. And let me say that both conventions are orchestrated always. They're political vehicles. But in terms of the Republican side, it always comes to who will be giving them the money, and it's a show. It's a show particularly for their base. And they cater to the lowest denominator. In this case, is that 28%, which is fire eaters, who will give their most to them, and it essentially is the Tea Party stormtroopers. On the other hand, the Democrats, well, they played games. Yeah, they do. We know that. They go back and forth. They have to find donors to get the convention going. But when we look at the product that comes out, it still comes out that the Democrats will go for that sector of the population that is needy. I would say that. And to be frank, let me say, I did not watch the Republican convention. Reason number one, I did not need any more acid reflux that I was getting. I knew that CNN would be giving me every bit later on, of course, slanted as could be. I don't need that type of thing. I did watch the Democratic convention. And definitely from what I've seen on both sides and all the descriptions and everything that goes on, there is quite a bit of enthusiasm on one side, and there wasn't any on the Republican side. I mean, it was almost like, hey, we're here to party, but really it's not the party. There wasn't much enthusiasm for Romney, and that follows in the days and, you know, week that have followed the whole thing. It's one catastrophe after the other for the Romney campaign, as we have seen. On the side of the Democrats, it seems like there is a rise. There seems to be a real bump coming up. And I wonder how this will translate into the election, given that we have already started the whole process of voting in several of the states. I mean, even before the first debate, there's already voting going on. And so everybody's getting influence in their vote every single day right now. And that concerns me. It's something that we all need to keep in mind and have a get-out-the-vote campaign for as many people as can do it. All elections have repercussions, and we're seeing it right now.
You know, one of my first impressions, because I was really watching these with, if you will, a couple different sets of eyes. With one, you know, the political input, the political chicanery. But with another eye, my academic training is in anthropology. And I was looking at crowd knowledge and crowd sense and crowd intelligence. And, you know, one of the things, my takeaway was there was a joyous coming together with the Democrats. They were you know, not just supporting an incumbent, but it seemed to me like they were reaffirming their values that we are in this together. It was kind of a response to what I heard was, I would say, the cry of an angry animal at the Republican convention. There was hurt. There was anger. And one of the things that Susan pointed out in her segment right at the top was that, you know, there was this betrayal of the Ron Paul contingent, where people were basically held hostage in buses, shuttled around across the town, not even allowed to come in, just so they could jigger the rules to keep the Ron Paul delegates off the floor, out of the convention, and then let them in once the rules were rewritten. And I don't know if that was the betrayal, but it strikes me as like this. Okay, they've annoyed the black community. They've annoyed the Hispanic community. They've ignored and insulted the women. Who the hell is their demographic?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but they haven't ignored the women's population. They've actually attacked it instead.
Well, right. Ignored it except where they've insulted. You're absolutely right, Mary.
Right.
There is something that is really interesting there, and that is that, you know, they're catering to diminishing returns. You're right. I mean, it's tribalism. It's tribalism of the worst kind that they have. And right now, they have this whole picture in their minds. I think that they're living a myth in terms of what's out there and the population. And we don't see that in the Democratic camp right now. In fact, that there's much positive view of things and what needs to be done. And I don't see that among the Republicans. But that's nothing new. I mean, they've been angry since years ago. I've been a participant of anti-war demonstrations, and I'll tell you what, I had a gun pointed at me from a car at one time, just because I was there on a street corner holding a sign with Veterans for Peace. And that is nothing absolutely new. The problem is it's getting worse. And the question is what's going to happen next. And that's what we all have to watch out. And the rhetoric particularly is evil, is insidious. Right now, it's a matter of what they want to provoke. Now, let me go back to something that happened several years ago. And when we're looking at past elections.
Luis?
Yes.
Let me interrupt just for a second. Hold that thought.
Sir.
I want to bring Rob on. He's waiting in the wings right now. Let me bring him on, then I'll let you finish your story, okay?
Right on.
Rob, welcome.
Hi, Rick. Thank you very much. I apologize. I guess I'm guilty of a misdemeanor tonight, arriving late
Rob.
To the conference.
Hold on one second, Rob. Luis is going to finish the story, then I'll let you talk a little bit, okay? Go ahead, Luis.
Yeah, one of the things that what I'm afraid of happens is, as these campaigns are taking place, back in the 1960s, while LBJ was trying to and this is factual, that he was actually trying to terminate that war in Vietnam. Richard Nixon was conspiring and working with the Vietnamese government secretly to keep it going until after the election. Years later, Ronald Reagan did pretty much the same thing, in which he, during all this campaigning, and everybody was focused on it, Reagan was actually working with Iranians to keep the American hostages prisoners for a longer period of time until the election was over and he could do in Jimmy Carter. So now the question is, what is the surprise that the Republicans are holding, and what is Romney willing to do, and is Bibi in Israel willing to come over with right now? So that's my really serious concern.
Sure, Rob. Let me ask you to give us your take overall. I know you attended Charlotte also.
I was at Ground Zero. I met some interesting people. I heard some interesting news. And I would like to follow up on, is that Louis? Louise?
Yep.
That's right.
No, is this speaking? Louise, good to talk to you again. I'd like to follow up on that. And I think we're seeing the seeds of the next Republican October surprise with the uprising in the Middle East. I don't think it's any coincidence that that's happening just before the election. And I think it's got Karl Rove's fingerprints all over it. So I just wanted to follow up with that thought. But I wanted to add something about the conventions. And it's true that they're a show for the public, but they're more than that. In my mind, I've been to a lot of conventions, not just this is my first national convention for a political party, but I've been to lots of conventions, and I can tell you that the conventions are not just about, in this case, a nomination, and it's not just about putting on a show for the people that are watching on their TVs. A lot of what goes on in the convention is inspiration, it's planning, it's training, and all of those things took place, and I think that 3,000 delegates left Charlotte last week and came back to their grassroots movements ready to do exactly what you said is necessary, Luis, is to get out the vote, to do the knocking on the doors, to get the grassroots movement going, so that on election day, even though the polling places are going to be lined up because they don't have enough polling booths in the Democratic precincts, and even though there's going to be a big, I don't know if you all have been following what the right is doing now, they're training up this army of poll watchers to go to the polls to try to discourage people in every precinct from being able to vote. Even though all that goes on, there's going to be so many Democrats at the polls that it's going to be overwhelming. I think that's what the convention did, in my mind.
All right, let me ask all three of you this question. You know, we basically had almost entirely a foreign policy-free convention on both sides. There was very little mention of the fact that we're at war in all these countries. We've got drone wars. We've got secret wars. We're in Africa. We're in the Middle East. We're in Far Asia. We're in South America and Central America. You know, I look at the two platforms. The Republican platform starts its section on foreign policy with the heading American Exceptionalism. And you look at the Democratic one, and it says, stronger in the world, safer and more secure at home. Let me start with you, Meredith. What does that tell you about the Democratic framing of the foreign policy issue?
Well, I mean, I think that the great part about it is not just that the Democrats had to make a statement as to how strong they were and almost defend against the attacks on President Obama that he wasn't strong. He's been the strongest leader that we've had in, as far as I can remember, as far as getting things accomplished, but they don't want to talk about that, so they're focusing, so the conservatives are focusing on that which he may not have been able to get to at this point. The great part about it is the Democrats have a history that they can look to say, look, this is what he's accomplished. They don't have to make a big, you know, they don't have to make a big statement, because the statement is, look at his record, he's done amazing things that no other president was able to do, including their representatives, their Republicans.
Luis, let me ask you the same question, sir.
Yeah.
Republican exceptionalism versus stronger at home.
On the Republican side, it's more of the same. It's a continuation of the Reagan-Bush years. It's essentially, we're out alone, and, you know, it's the U.S. against the world. But, you know, that's our view. And it's a continuation of the preemptive attacks policy. Unfortunately, the Obama administration has followed up on some of that and continues to get involved in those overseas activities that were left there with Bush, and they haven't changed. Of course, there's also something to be said, and there's elements within the administration that are a continuation of, you know, the past, and they have not been taken out. And that means advisors and all kinds of people in the system. In terms of Obama's vision, there is quite a difference. The question is, how will the people continue to push and influence the administration? It's easier with Obama than obviously is going to be with a Romney administration, where there is absolutely no possibility of influencing these people, and they will continue to do their extreme right wing policies. And that's
John
where
Bolton.
That's where you get people like that. And of course, you've got people in the background like Jeb Bush, who is pushing his way in. You will see this, you know, that there is a different, kind of a battle within the Republican Party right now. And I'm almost willing to bet that for 2016, Jeb Bush has positioned himself right in there, and he is just waiting for Romney to fall. Blame everything on Romney, and then boom, take out there and come out. And he has positioned himself, and he's really going to make the wedge in terms of the education president. He's manipulating his way in right there.
I agree
and
completely.
That's scary.
Let me ask Rob. Rob, same question. How would you characterize that American exceptionalism versus stronger at home, stronger abroad? The Democrat versus the Republican platform. Can you characterize that in just a couple minutes?
Well, I would start out with two different visions of what American exceptionalism is. I think that in the Republican terms, American exceptionalism means we're better than everybody else just because we say so. And I think that most people who are not Tea Party types believe that we are exceptional because we used to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, and we used to believe in a system of justice where a man was innocent until proven guilty, and we used to be a nation of laws and not of, of men. And I think that that just the significance of that difference between our concepts of American exceptionalism, we earn the title, in my view, American exceptionalism by our behavior. We don't declare it and then expect everybody else to bow down to it. So having said that, that in terms of the question of Democrats versus Republicans, or convention versus convention, in terms of expressing foreign policy, I think that your first guest, what's the young lady's name?
Susan Nyland, the Nyland Report.
Susan. Hi, Susan. I think she's absolutely right. I think our president has a history. I think we see that he's reestablished our respect among the nations, that we're no longer viewed as the rogue nation that just tries to impose our will on everybody else. And I think the GOP view, if you look at Romney, he's surrounding himself by exactly the same foreign policy people, exactly the same chicken hawks that George W. Bush surrounded himself during his presidency. So a lot of people say that, you know, the Republicans are trying to go back to the pre-60s before, you know, birth control was an established reality for females. Or some people say that the Republicans are trying to go back to the, the 1800s, back when, before we had a 14th Amendment. My view is that the Republicans are trying to take us back to the Middle Ages, when civilizations lived in walled societies because the hordes were trying to attack them. And I think that's where Romney would like to take us with his plutocracy. I think the walled cities that we're building today, the gated communities, are an example of that. And if we let the GOP get in, and even if we don't let the GOP get in, I think we face the real possibility of civil war in the United States. And I think the Koch brothers would like nothing more than to see us engage in a civil war.
Okay, let me get one more question in before we have to wrap it up, and I want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to weigh in. Now, it seems to me, you know, other than Luis's incredibly dark guess that there's an October surprise waiting to do this, it just seems to me awfully puzzling that you have a party like the Republicans. You know, make your arguments what you will, economic, conservative, social, whatever. But if you alienate women and Hispanics and African Americans and the educated and anyone who's ever gotten government assistance, whether it be a senior citizen getting Social Security or a student getting a student loan, and you tell the American people that these are all freeloaders, I mean, short of an October surprise, I don't see where you get an electorate. Let me ask Meredith first. Meredith, what do you think is the overall strategy on the Republican side?
Well, I think that's just it, and it's one of the reasons that McCain and Palin had lost. It's one of the reasons that I think Hillary had a hard time against Obama, because Obama has a very clear-cut strategy. The strategy that the Obama campaign has demonstrated is very clear, it's very concise, and it's very cutting. And I don't think that the Republicans have a strategy against that they're sticking to. It's one of the problems that we lost, that we've lost some of the other races in the state as well, is that the candidate's campaign is not sticking to talking points. They're not sticking to strategy because they're on the defensive. Once you're on the defensive, you've lost it, and they're not going to win. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's exactly what we're seeing. There's pretty much at this point, he just keeps making one gaffe after another. And the fascinating thing to me is that if this 47% was the first time we've heard something like that from him, then it would be a concern. But just a few months ago, he also said that he doesn't care about poor people. So, I mean, when you put those together, there's a very, you know, the strategy is out the window when his real self comes in and is basically his real opinion is that he doesn't care about poor people, and it's throughout the entire campaign.
Well, he's consistent anyway.
Right.
Thank
right.
you, Meredith. Thank you. Louise, who's
yeah,
his constituency?
let me say, remember one thing. This is the most ideological party in the history of the United States in the longest period of time. They have this Randian vision of how things should be. And one of the things that really concerns me is that while they are doing all this talking, they are, on the other hand, working very consistently on getting votes out there, slashing out the votes. They are repressing voters. They're going against, if they can take certain percentage of the black vote away and certain percentage of the Latino vote away and so on and so forth through their electoral repression methodology, what they're hoping is that at the end of the day, they will have stolen the election. And that's why we need to get people out there to vote, big time, because otherwise they will make slashes into the system. And they're not beneath that. And the other one thing is that people forget. We have the worst thing in the system, which is all these electronic voting machines. How that has gotten out of the of the vernacular and the things that we discuss is incredible. And there is no outrage at voter suppression. There's no talk about these machines that won't. If you go to the ATM, you go to the bank, and you go to the ATM, you get a receipt. But you go to your to cast a vote, you get nothing. It's like that. The Coke machine that takes, or the soda machine that steals your money. You got nothing back. And then you cannot prove that you put anything in there anyway. So that's what really concerns me. There's a lot of talk. And I'll tell you one thing that really irks me, and that is the fact that if you remember way back in, before 2008, the conversation was pretty much the same. McCain, Palin, they're going to overwhelm. They're going to wipe out. They're going to do all these things. On the election day, I was sitting with a few friends, and everybody was on their computers. We were looking at all these things, and a note slashed right through and says, 7:30 p.m., and Karl Rove throws his arms up, and he says that Obama is going to win by 330 Electoral College votes. No discussion about that. They didn't appear in the media. And boom, it happened, 338 Electoral College votes. Overwhelming victory.
That's the only way it makes sense to me they could win. Let me get Rob in there real quick for a final comment. Rob, be as brief as you can. I've got a little segment at the end, Sarah Silverman complaining about voter fraud. So go ahead, Rob, quick.
Who is the Republicans' constituent? The same knuckle-dragging Neanderthals that voted for Daniel Webster against Alan Grayson. It's the church people that cling to their guns and their Bibles that will believe anything the preacher tells them, and that believes that President Obama is a Kenyan Muslim socialist. Plus the other communist. There is a community of people that no matter how much they hate Mitt Romney, they hate President Obama more. That's their constituency.
Well, thank you so much, everybody, for joining us for this unconventional talk about conventions. I wanted to wait until the temper's cooled and I could get these wonderful brains of yours involved and we can kind of look at an overview. Thank you all so much. And if you can stick around and listen to this, this is Sarah Silverman, who's a little bit of a vulgarian now. Sarah Silverman's take on voter fraud. So forewarned is forearmed. I think you're going to like this. It's really straight from the very hip. Hold on. Here she goes.
Hey, black people, old people, poor people, and students. Guess what you all have in common? Lawmakers are trying to fuck you in your assholes. Hey, y'all, it's me, your Jewish friend, Sarah.
I mean, though I can play Italian or, like, a black Irish.
Can you believe it's election time again? Time to go to the local polling place, cross your name off the list, and vote. But this year, it's not going to be that easy, because there are these brand new, super fucked up laws, which are presented as a way to prevent voter fraud, but are in fact designed to make it hard for specific people to vote. Black people, elderly people, poor people, and students. I wonder what those demographics have in common. Oh yeah, they're probably going to vote for this guy. Hey, it's for our own protection, to prevent voter fraud. Oh yeah, all that crazy voter fraud going around. There's so much fraud around that free and anonymous civil right. You know, a lot of these laws require you to have a state-issued picture ID, like a driver's license. But more than 21 million Americans don't have driver's licenses.
What about my Social Security card? I've been using it for 70 years.
No photo, no voto. I'm on to your shenanigans, Marie Gershans, if that is your real name. Next?
My veteran photo ID card?
Is your address on it?
No.
Oh, then no.
I lost my legs for this country.
Look, you want fair, move to Canada, hippie.
I have a purple heart!
Big deal! I have a yellow discharge! I mean, I have a cream for it. This attempt to prevent voter fraud is itself the only voter fraud taking place. You think I'm being paranoid? Look at this.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
And how about this bullshit? Some students, like in Tennessee, because of the new voter identification laws, will not be able to use their student IDs to vote. But, and this is amazing, gun owners can use their firearm permits as ID to vote. It makes perfect sense. Get these kids gun permits. Ugh, I feel safer from voter fraud already. What a great time to be encouraging our young people to go out and get a firearm license, don't you think? It's just like so American. So let's do it. If you live in one of these voter suppression states, make sure that everyone you know gets the ID necessary to vote, even if that means taking Nana to get a license to kill. And it just makes sense, you know, when you think about it. I mean, cars cost tens of thousands of dollars, but if you can get a gun, you can get a ride virtually anywhere. By taking that step to make sure you have the proper ID to vote, you'll be making your voice heard. And, more importantly, you'll be telling those motherfuckers they can fucking fuck themselves.
Sarah!
Man, it's true. Go to this website. Click on it. I'm hoping I'm pointing to some sort of Chiron and not just my vagina. Don't let these assholes steal your vote.
Yeah, that's gangster style.
Go to this website, click on your state, and it will tell you exactly what you need to do.
Whoa! As a kiss!
Like your lemonade. I'm Sarah Silverman, and I approve this message.
Well, Sarah doesn't pull any punches in that. And it's a big issue, as you said, you know, short of voter fraud, jiggering the machines, and an October surprise, I can't imagine there's any way that President Obama doesn't get reelected. And let's hope that our darkest fears are not true. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. Any final comments, Meredith?
Yes. Palm Beach County now is participating with about nine other women's organizations, including everything from the League of Women Voters to the to some of the more conservative women's groups, and we're doing and the Jewish Council for Jewish Women. We're doing a WAPA event. It's called the Women's Alliance for Political Awareness on September 30th from 2 to 5. It's free of charge South County Civic Center in Boca Raton.
Thank you so much. Lewis, any final comment?
Yes, just to everybody out there, help get the word out there. Go vote. Help somebody go vote. And help somebody get an ID card so that they can also vote.
Well, thank you again, my friends. Thanks for joining me. Next week, Progressive News Network will be covering Middle Eastern issues. So tune in September 30th. On behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce, thanks so much. Thanks again, finally, to my guests. Couldn't do it without you. You all hang in there. Solidarność, my friends.
Thanks, Rick.
Solidarność. Good night. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.